The host starts off with the same question to all our guests, which is, you know, asking about the spiritual context of your childhood and, you know, in the home that you were raised in, kind of giving a background of that spiritual context.
Okay. Am I on?
You are on. I can hear you.
Okay. Well, I, being an African American, we're very passionate about our religion and our practice. And my family was not that religious. They didn't go to church. My brother did, and he would take my sister and myself. And it was a wonderful place for me. It was where I wanted to be. I would go every day of the week if I could. The joy that seemed to be there, the camaraderie, the real interest, the getting into the Bible, trying to understand what it means, not just going through, you know, the motions of saying I go to church or dipping your finger in the holy water, but really it's a part of our life that I think is in our genes, because we needed some kind of faith, something to grasp hold to. In our ancestral slavery in this country. And I think that that's one reason why perhaps Buddhism is not as attractive to African Americans as a whole as some other or theistic type of religion. You know, we coming from a time where we had masters, and even in the times that I was still in church, we went to church to get fussed at, yelled at every Sunday. You know, the pastor would tell us what we need to do and that we need a leader, and we'd say, sure, you're right, amen, hallelujah, you know. And so there's a time gap in the process here. We haven't spent the last 200 years being whatever we wanted to be, doing whatever we wanted to do, having whatever we wanted to have until we're just sick of ourselves and looking for a way out. Most of us are still looking for a way in. We're still waiting for our ship to come in. Mm-hmm. We're still looking for that fame, looking for prosperity, looking for acceptance. And so I'm often asked why there are not more African Americans on the Buddhist path, and I think this is one reason. It's not the only reason, but I think this is one reason. And so, being so fervent in my spiritual practice, you know, as a Christian, I think set my whole life into motion and put me on a course to be fervent about everything. You know, there's a scripture that talks about the fervent, effectual prayer of the righteous avails much, you know. So it's easy for me to get into some type of a revolutionary stance in regards to social work, where I believe that only the most drastic actions matter. Everything came down to a matter of the heart, a matter of the heart. And so something could bypass the head if you felt it in the heart. You could go for it. You could get behind it, you know, 100%. And this is the kind of outpicturing from my early spiritual life that informs my practice and my service in the community, my co-laboring together with others all the way up to today.
Wow. I think I've never heard that explanation of why there's not more African Americans in Buddhism, and I think that mm-hmm. that makes sense in a lot of ways. Does that sit well with kind of your Baptist colleagues and your?
Absolutely not. I haven't found too many people that it sits well with. Nevertheless, I'm not saying that is the reason. I'm just saying that's my, you know, it's my view of one. One reason.
You describe an experience when you're in the Baptist church as a young woman where you start to speak in tongues and the church said that wasn't real. Can you talk a little bit more about that, and then how you made sense of that experience at the time and how you make sense of that experience today.
I was 13, and you know, I'd been going to church since I was about 6, and I really loved it, and I would pray when I was at home, and it was like Jesus was a constant companion, you know, just thoughts of the holy life on my mind, the way you can make sense of it as a 13-year-old. And so one night when I was in bed, you know, I was just praying fervently, and I felt this rush of energy just like coming up from out of my belly. It was so strong, and, you know, and then it just spewed forth this, I don't know, it was this language, and it wasn't that I understood what I was saying, but one thing I could definitely say was that I felt I was in a washing. I was in a cleansing. Mm-hmm. Something was happening, but it was erupting out of me. And I went to church that Sunday, and I told my pastor. He said, no, that passed away with the apostles. So then I decided, okay, well, you all can't help me because you don't even know what this is. And I decided to look for someplace else to go. And so my brother, I think it was my sister, she said, you know, they have these people that go to these storefront churches, and they call them holy rollers. They do that kind of thing, you know, and they shout and they dance. And so I went to check them out, and there I found community for, you know, a portion of my walk. I ultimately decided, you know, I got tired of breaking up the furniture, shouting every Sunday and step out the door. And if you got me wrong, you were in trouble. You know, I was like, how can this be? How can hot and cold come out of the same fountain? I can be so spiritual, so loving in one moment, and you get me wrong, you know, the next moment I'm all over you. Mm-hmm. And so that led me on to what they call the word churches, where we really started studying what the scriptures meant and how to really walk in them, how to train in something, to train the mind, and how to develop, to cultivate some qualities of being, not just being in the spirit when the mood hits you, but when it doesn't hit you. Mm-hmm. And all of those experiences really laid the foundation for me to step into the deeper spiritual life that I found in studying the Dharma.
That's beautiful. Between kind of you know, your slight pivot from Christianity to Buddhism, you describe these years of darkness. Can you speak a little bit more about that? What are the questions that you were asking yourself, and you know, how did that transition from Christianity to Buddhism, you know, occur?
Yeah, and I want to clarify that they weren't years of darkness. When I think of a dark night of the soul, I think of a person just not knowing. Mm-hmm. You know, so darkness in the sense of ignorance, mm-hmm. Not necessarily harmfulness, but this. Confounded by the mystery of things, and searching everywhere to try to find some clarity, some answers about the meaning of life and who and what exactly is God, or when I get some message about, you know, of how to help someone, and it was like a literal speaking in my ear, like, what is that? I mean, you know, and I needed answers beyond, oh, that's the gift of the Holy Spirit, because I knew people who were better than me. I'll just tell you. You know, I wasn't always that good. I still am not. But, you know, I felt if there were some gifts being handed out, there were a lot of people I could think of that would be ahead of me in the line. And so I needed another answer, you know, that made more sense. And I began searching. So I started with unity because Was it unity, because unity is very close. You know, it's like one hop away from mainstream Christianity, and that felt comfortable. Someone before that had given me a Buddhist book. It was a Tibetan book on dependent origination. And when I saw the picture that was just on the cover of the book, I just said, that's demonic. I don't want to even open this book. I don't even want to have anything to do with it. And I missed my opportunity, you know, to for the Dharma. And it was 15 years before it came back around. But during that 15 years, I definitely got ready for it. You know, so I touched so many things. From Unity, I went to UU, and from there I went into shamanism, and from there I went to Taoism. And you know, so just touching just about every spiritual discipline, just trying to investigate to understand what things were. And then you put them into the cauldron of your own experience, and you sit with something. Something that doesn't have to be poison for it just to not be palatable, palatable for you. So some things I would sort of spit out because, you know, it just wasn't my taste. Not judging that particular discipline, it just wasn't my taste. It wasn't a kind of flavor, you know, that I liked. But I tried to go into everything with an open mind, you know, to really examine it, experience it from its own side. And then I'd sit and say, is this for me?
Well, and what was it that finally kind of drew you into the Dhamma?
Well, from the very beginning, my inner cry was, I'd always been compassionate, but I didn't have much wisdom. And that can really create problems for you and for other people. And so I was like, I can't get this wisdom thing, you know. So where can I find wisdom? And I, you know, early in my Christian walk, you know, some of my favorite passages were about wisdom. Wisdom cries in the street. If it cries in the street, how come I can't hear it, you know? And so I was always making mistakes out of a good heart, you know, but just not having enough wisdom. So that's what I was really looking for. And as I begin to gradually move, I guess, towards this particular practice, which I think is the just the epitome of the wisdom path, I begin to develop a little bit more confidence that I was developing wisdom. I was learning something. And when a Buddhism came in front of me, I was so ready for it. You know, I had to get rid of so many fears before I was ready for it. I had to let go of so much clinging around certain notions, around certain beliefs. You know, you can have some experiences and you don't know what they are about, what means they've come about, how to interpret them. And so the when they occur within a certain vessel, then you kind of go with the explanation that the leaders, you know, of that boat tell you. But I knew that wisdom was developing because I was able to discriminate between the experience and the container. And that's when I knew I was making progress on the path. And so when I got into the Dharma, and the Dharma really starts with this working. It's a mind training, you know. I was ready for it.
Do you have any specific examples about that separation between the experience and the container?
I do. For instance, there was a time when I would get like a sort of like an urging or an unction, is what we would call it, that something important is getting ready to happen, you know. So I would feel this coming, rising up in the inside. So I make myself ready for whatever important is about to happen. And then I might hear something inside that says maybe get in the car and drive down the street. Mm. And at some point they say, make a right here and make a left here. Now stop, go knock on that door. There's somebody sick. Go in
wow.
and tell them such and such. You know what I'm saying? Okay, now where did this, you know, where did this voice come from inside of my head? So my pastor said, oh, that's the voice of the Holy Spirit speaking to you. So I think that's the voice of the Holy Spirit speaking to me. What is Holy Spirit? You know, I don't know. It's what somebody has told me that it is, you know. That's the way God communicating in the third person to me. And so I accept that. But by this time, there was some feeling that that wasn't a good enough explanation for me. And so I encounter the Dharma. And the Dharma helps me to understand this, what I call voice, in a little different way. And even what I might call the Holy Spirit in a little different way. You know, you're getting in that stillness, waiting like a waiter in a fine restaurant waits on a table. He doesn't stand too close to the guests, not too far. And he stands there expectant, looking for the slight nod of a head, looking for the water glass to get down to a certain level, and he's right there being attentive. You know, it's that kind of waiting. And so I got this idea that as I was entering into this stillness, hyper-alert, vigilant, yet peaceful, perhaps, as the Dharma says, I'm tapping in to some capacity that is always available to me on some level of mind. And so there's an expansion of your skills, of your capabilities. You know, we have a certain bandwidth that we, you know, that we can hear. Dogs can hear more than we can hear, you know. There's, we have a certain bandwidth by which we see. And there are some other animals that see a lot more than we can see. You know, sometimes, you know, some of us are more sensitive to others. You know, I can step into a dark room, but I can know instantly if somebody's in that dark room. Other people might just step in the room and they don't know. You know, they don't feel it, you know. And so it's like that. And but where on that band is my capability, my yeah. capacity, and can that be expanded through cultivation? I think the Buddha tells us that it can be, you know. And so we undergo this training to be fit and useful, first for ourselves, for our own enlightenment, our own awakening, and then to be of use to others.
Well, that's some of the best explanations of the Dhamma that I've heard in a while. Thank you for that. For young people, or you know, even not so young people that are trying to find their way in the world and feeling a bit lost or confused, what are the questions that you think they should be asking themselves? Or I think that. Because I feel like this conversation about inner and outer work, there's a lot of us that do a lot of outer work and are trying to make a life and trying to do good, and there can still be kind of these questions that are unclear and this confusion that arises. What would you tell people that are the questions that they should be asking themselves, which obviously you were asking yourself as you kind of came into the Dhamma?
Well, first I want to say I think young people are the greatest, you know, because we're brutally honest with ourselves and sometimes brutally honest with others. You know, when we see something that's not right, you know, or we recognize that it's just it's not beneficial, We say so, and there is an indignation that arises, you know, because we haven't gone through it for so long that we've decided, well, you know, you can't beat City Hall. You just go with it. We're like, yes, we can. We can beat City Hall. We can stand against this. We can stand for justice. And that's why I think young people are so great. What I would say to young people is to be encouraged. This great passion that you feel that is so painful sometimes, you know, is really, really your strength. As a mother, you know, I have children, and I tell you, childbirth is no laughing matter. It's no joke. It really hurts. That's what I would say. But there is something in the process of delivery, this knowing of what you're bringing into the world that makes you be able to bear even that level of pain. Mm. And the thing is that once the baby is out, in moments, the pain is forgotten.
Yeah.
And so I think because you're at a time when you're so into your feelings and your desire to make things count and that only the most drastic actions matter, that you recognize that pain comes with that.
Mm.
And if you can accept that painful feeling comes with that, it's just part of the package. It will help you not be overcome by the painful feelings. So I think that meditation is important. And, you know, if we speak of meditation, there's a great movement towards, you know, mindfulness practice and so forth in our country, and I think it's absolutely wonderful. But I would have to say that that which brings the most comfort, you know, the heartwood of the Buddhist teaching is on voidness, that nothing is worthy to be called me, my, or mine. So he teaches us a certain way of removing the personal parts of things so that we can look at them. You know, if something's too close to you and you try to look at it, you actually have double vision. You can't see it. But put it back a bit, like arm's length, and then you can look at it. And so he says that everything in life should be like this. Just put it sort of at arm's length. Mm. Even your views, even what you're passionate about, even how you feel about things, just still put it at arm's length and take a look. And in doing that, you soothe the pain a bit.
Mm.
And when the pain is soothed just a bit, you can begin to come up with more creative ways to approach a situation. And so that would be my advice, to just know that pain comes with this level of passion and wanting to do good. But you have to put everything like arm's length.
Mm.
And if you do, you'll find the mind-body coming into a kind of balance and ease that will allow you to be more effective.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that is often misunderstood about Buddhism and activism, that this idea that being at arm's length is kind of a detachment or an apathy, that, you know, in fact it can bring clarity and even deeper engagement or more impactful engagement.
Yeah, I think just some translations have messed us up, you know, because we talk about, you know, non-attachment, and we talk about aloofness, and, you know, these words mean certain things to us. And when we use them, we paint a picture around them. And then I see so many people, you know, really in avoidance or just not willing, I mean, like out of sight, out of mind. And that, I don't think that that's what the Buddha was talking about at all. As a matter of fact, if you just look at his life and his encouragements, you'll see that he was very much engaged. Matter of fact, I consider him a revolutionary. You know, he was doing things that were unthinkable in his day. You know, women were chattel; they didn't go into spiritual practice. You know, but yet he had He had women in his communities. He had high caste and low caste and no caste all living together. Mm-hmm. He had rich and poor all living together, you know. And so there was something extremely engaging in that practice in the beginning. You know, he said the whole of spiritual life is good friends in the Dharma. Mm-hmm. So that lets us know that this notion that some of us have of pursuing spirituality and being disconnected from what's going on in the world, you know, it should let us know that we've got something a little wrong with that.
Yeah. So in the context of, you know, Ferguson and the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and, you know, the many sufferings of our world, how does an individual, you know, like yourself, engage in those things that are both, you know, distant and near and hard to make sense of?
Just like that. when I'm asked the tough questions, you know, I always laugh first, and that balances me a little mm-hmm. bit, you know, brings me back to a middle point. I just came back from India, and, you know, the needs are so great working with some of the colonies that we work with, and that's what they call them, these hamlets at the end of the villages where the untouchables are, you know, and they think that I have it so great in America. And I try to share with them some of what we're actually doing here. You know, and it's pretty much a blackout over there. And they're like, what? We can't believe it. No, you know, America is paradise. You know, so it's I think it used to be for some folk and not for others. Now I'm not sure it is for any of us, you know. But sometimes things have to get so bad, you know, before they can begin to get better. A little off, and we consider it isolated, not systemic, you know. But when it's shown in its fullness, and we can see how pervasive something is, then I think we're positioned to be able to take action. And I really look for the Buddhist community to realize that this is our destiny. I think Sulak, the co-founder of the International Network of Engaged Buddhism, said, he has a quote that I just love, said, Buddhism is not concerned just with private destiny, but with the lives and consciousness of all beings, and any attempt to understand Buddhism apart from a social dimension is fundamentally a mistake. Wow. And until Western Buddhists understand this, the embrace of Buddhism is not going to help very much in the efforts to bring about meaningful and positive social change, or even in the struggle to transform their own egos. I tell you, that's the end of the conversation right there. Kind of say, what does this mean? And ponder it, and then look at their own lives and see where they are on that spectrum. You know, we would go a long way in being the change that we want to see in the world.
And, you know, I think American Buddhism, you know, sometimes is seen as kind of this middle class or upper middle class white movement that is focused on self-improvement or personal concentration, you know, the Googles of the world that are potentially disengaged from community or society. Is that your sense, or do you feel like the American Buddhism is incrementally kind of making steps towards what you're speaking about, which is a deeply engaged kind of proactive, almost activist stance on justice and solidarity?
Well, I, you know, if you go back to the beginning and how it was introduced and who it was introduced to in this country, who brought it back to this country, you know, you have to admit that it's a meditation was a white elite pastime. And so, you know, we weren't there in the beginning, those of us who were struggling and having a hard time. And then when we did come, you know, it was sort of like an infiltration. So I think that it is, there's a little struggle going on to keep it like it originally was. You know, it was better then. We didn't have to get into all these issues about diversity and all that when we just had our little group and we were sitting Om Shanti and we were doing all these things and everything was fine. Now it's getting complicated, you know. And I think that we're trying to respond to it. I'm not so sure we're responding in the right way because I don't think we've had a sufficient immersion in the Dhamma. Mm. You know, I think we've had some meditation, and I think we've put out, we've put forth a lot of effort in one aspect of the path. You know, but there's seven other aspects. You know, not just mindfulness. And on top of that, it wasn't just mindfulness, it's right mindfulness. Mm. I mean, your mindfulness, I mean, we're already mindful of things. Just what are we mindful of? So our mindfulness needs to be informed by something. And because we haven't had a deep enough immersion in the whole Dhamma, we're coming away with an impotent practice that's not helping much. You know, it's not even helping us, much less other people. So meditating, you know, and 20 years, you know, and you're saying still crazy after all these years. That's because there's some necessary. We have this bakery with the young people here and. And I could tell you, because I knew nothing about baking bread, but I can tell you that you have to have all of the ingredients for it to taste right. And you have to put them in a certain order or it doesn't come out right. Yeah. And not only do you have to put them in a certain order, but you have to make sure that when you put them in, you follow certain instructions for how to put them in. For instance, when I first glanced at the recipe, I knew we had... what do you call that? It's not yeast. Mm-hmm. And when it got on the line of the recipe to put the yeast, for the yeast, I just opened the pack and I put the yeast in. But see, I didn't read the whole recipe first because at the bottom it told how to prepare the yeast. First you had to put it in 110 degree water for whatever it was, 3 minutes, and then you put it into the mix. And because I didn't do that, the bread didn't rise.
Yes.
Okay, so then I made some more yeast, put it in the 110 degree water, and put it in, and then it activated the yeast that was already in there, and then I had a double rise, you know. And so all of life, you know, we can learn something from everything, something even as simple as learning how to properly bake a loaf of bread, you know. And so when I'm looking at us struggling to be effective, but yet we haven't read all the instructions, you know.
Yeah.
Or we've only put in the parts that we like. And, you know, in America, we don't like to hear anything about right or wrong. You know, we don't want those words in our vocabulary. We don't want to hear anything about wholesome and unwholesome. You know, we don't want to hear anything about virtue and non-virtue. We basically want to know how to be happy with our things.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm seeing people realizing now that there's got to be more to it than this.
How important.
And I'm happy about that because that's where all my students come from. Most of them have been practicing 10, 20, 30 years, and they finally got to the point that they said, got to be more to it than this. You know, because I'm still anxious. I still get angry. You know, I still have a lot of deep-seated sadness and misery. I mean,
yeah.
What I would do, I don't do. What I don't want to do, I do.
Mm-hmm.
This is where I came in. That was my beef with my my Christian practice.
Yeah.
That I love God with all my heart, but you, I could have a problem with. How could this be? And what I didn't want to do, sometimes I found myself doing. And what I wanted to do, many times I didn't do. So when people come to me in Buddhism, like, I totally understand it. You see, because Buddhism is a label, Christianity is a label.
Yeah.
Those are all just labels. If you go beyond the labels, putting aside the labels, to what motivates and moves us towards our greatest human potential, you know, then we start to see that there is a definite path that leads towards that. And there are definite practices and activities that lead away from that.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's beautiful.
I just wanted to, sorry, Sri, just really quick, we're going to open it up to questions from the audience in just a couple of minutes as we're still hearing more questions from Sri. But I wanted to share that please dial *6 in order to queue up if you have any questions that you would like to ask Venerable Panavati. Thank you, Sri.
Thanks, Efrain. There's a bunch more questions that I have for you, but I'll keep it just a couple more. Can you talk about what is a day in the life of Venerable Panavati in terms of your practice? Is it, are you meditating? Is it mostly service? Is it a combination of both? Is there chanting or other types of contemplation?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, my day is not programmed because every day is its own day, you know, and so we have to just show up, you know, and bear witness to the day and do what needs to be done. But there is sitting on the pillow, that's not practice. That's preliminary, you know. Practice is, you know, what you do in the moment dealing with the vicissitudes of life. And so the Buddha says that we train, you know, sitting secluded, quite secluded from unwholesome mental states and from a lot of external distractions to learn how to center ourselves, to settle ourselves, to come to that still point. He says, but it's no good if you can only do it when you go into a quiet room and sitting by yourself. No, it's when somebody's yelling at you, when somebody's calling you by the N word, or somebody's following you around in the store, or when somebody, you know, is rolling their eyes at you, or you, maybe not even saying anything to you, but you just feel it, you know, because you are in some way different from them, you know, then can you find that still space in that moment? If so, then you're a practitioner. So we learn to meditate at all times, on the pillow, off the pillow, when we're walking, when we're working. It becomes a state that you can find and be at peace and be focused no matter what's going on around you. So, yes, I have times of sitting every day, you know, but that's because for me that time in a sitting meditation is like, for young people I would say like slipping away to see your lover, you know, like personal time, you know. So I do it because I just like being able to get away to be alone with the stillness, you see. But by continually dipping my toe in that stillness, you know, I know where to find it, how to pull it up at almost at any time. And I know when that stillness in me is slipping away, you know, because I'm so familiar. I'm so familiar with it. So my day is mostly responding. to whatever comes up. So that could be, you know, some crises with the youth or youth at the bakery or something. Like right now I'm looking at the fact that I need to raise $100,000 by March to start building this school in India. And yeah, I could feel a little bit of pressure around that because I've got a dozen college kids, you know. The college is paying for them, the university is paying for them to fly there to for 2 weeks to do the first building phase. So I know I've got to find that money by then. You know, so what do I do at that at this moment? So I'm there looking for grants part of the day, or I'm making phone calls and I'm trying to share the vision and the, you know, and the investment of the work that we're doing. And then somebody will call and, you know, they have a personal problem. My husband just left me. My dog died. I lost my job. And helping them to find the Buddha nature inside in that moment. And then dealing with my own, you know, with my own situations as well. My day is just like your day. You know, we think that, well, I don't know if all monks' days are like mine. Because I made a decision that people are my forest. You said in your introduction that I was ordained Mahayana, and that's true, Chan, but also ordained Theravada. And that's, you know, my primary practice, or it's the practice that filters through all my other practices. And, of course, you know, forest monks are just used to meditating and sitting in the forest. But for me, people are my forest. Mm-hmm. So I sit amongst the people and touched by their feelings of infirmity.
After so many years as a nun, how much does being a black nun inform your worldview? Is it something that is still kind of in the day-to-day, your blackness is very relevant, or is it something that you don't kind of hold as your identity as much anymore? And then I think that your story of how you came to work in India is really fascinating, so I think after that, Afreen had a couple more questions, but just talking about your blackness as a black nun, and then potentially sharing a little bit about how you came to work in India.
And as you're about to share that, Venerable Panavati, I just wanted to add to the audience, please dial *6 if you'd like to get added to the queue of questions once we open it up to the audience. I think we have a couple of folks in queue already. But thank you. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. Everything is two-sided, you know. You hold up a coin and you have heads on one side and you have tails on the other. I don't think of myself as black, but I know other people do, you know. And I don't see it as affecting or informing my life as a nun, but other people do. Whenever I go, you know, 99.5% of my audience is Caucasian.
Yeah.
My whole sangha is white. When I'm invited to speak around the country, you know, well, in the beginning they invited me to speak at people of color, you know, events, and I turned down the invitations and say, I'm not a black Dharma teacher, I'm a Dharma teacher. So if you want me to talk to your whole sangha, invite me again. You know? And so I've been very clear about that. But it seems like I sort of can't get away from it. You know, so I'm asking myself, what responsibility do I have to maybe be an advocate for unity? You know, and I'm giving that a lot of thought. diversity is like such a buzzword today, but I don't really think the Buddha talked that much about diversity. He did talk about unity. Yeah. You know, he talked about unification of mind. And he would talk about how he had all different kinds in his community. And he'd say, other people do this, but we don't do that here. You know. And he taught them not how to divide into groups to feel safe, but how to sit in their uncomfortableness, but in their honesty, you know, continuing to dialogue and continuing to try to overlook faults and build relationships until those things dissolved. Mm. And I think that that's the direction that we need to take in our sanghas. I mean, we can't really take it out there to the world if it's not in our sanghas. That's just it, you know. And so we have some homework to do. We have some work we need to do within our own community. And when we've done that, then we have something real that we can take to the world instead of just, you know, instead of just platitudes. So I think we have to learn through developing friendships how to overlook differences, and then how to respect others' opinions and how to challenge our own assumptions about things. And that can only happen by us being together and not separate and apart. Awesome. Know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. That's beautiful. Before you get into your work in India, I think there's other people that have questions, so maybe we'll circle back to that.
Okay.
Afreen?
Yeah, we definitely, let's take a couple more questions here. And just, it's so lovely to hear this insightful conversation, Sri, with you and Venerable Panavati. So I think Mark has a question. And Mark, you're unmuted if you'd like to go ahead and ask.
This is Mark, but I didn't dial into the queue. I don't have a question at this time.
Okay. No problem. Maybe something on the switchboard. So star 6, if you have any questions that you would like to ask Venerable Panavati. And while we're while folks are dialing in for that, Venerable Panavati, it would definitely be lovely to hear about your work in India, as Sri was referencing. I watched a video where you were sharing about how you got involved with the Dalit community in India, and I think particularly with Ambedkar's work with the Dalit community and you know, the sort of Buddhist practices that have been adopted. It's just very interesting to hear your insights into that history as well as the present, what's currently living there.
Well, what I will say is that I wasn't prepared to what I saw because I felt that there were very, you know, few people in the world who had suffered, you know, more than those of us from African ancestry. But when I got there, and I was really shocked, and the fact that it could be not, it's, you have to look really closely to see it. Everything is so well known how one should act and what one should do, that the, you know, a visitor or a tourist might miss it completely. You know, but being there with them for weeks and walking among them, I begin to see the differences. And even when we go, we have to be so careful in which hotels we select to stay in, you know, because some will not be welcoming to our Dalit sisters and brothers to just come and meet us for brainstorming sessions and that sort of thing. But I was asked to come and to teach the Dhamma, to give Diksha and to teach the Dhamma. And the first time I went, around 250 people took Diksha. They converted from Hindu to Buddhism. They simply said that the Hindu faith offers them no hope of advancement, and that's what they were looking for. So it wasn't so much that they were looking for a deep spiritual practice, but they were looking for hope as a people, you know, some way that encouraged them to advance in society, to just become human, you know, since they're considered non-human. And so I realized that it was no point in trying to teach the Dharma, per se. You know, they needed an example for that. So I said, well, you know, okay, so we'll get to the Dharma in a little while, but right now, I mean, you don't have water. So let's see if we can get you some water. You know, and we started fundraising to build a well, and we completed one, and we're working on our second well, and we have a third well planned along with the school. So, and after water, you know, well, they don't have toilets either. You know, sanitation is really an issue, and so many children are stunted in their intellectual capacity because of just poor sanitation, you know, parasites and things that affect their brain, and many die. So I said, well, now that you have water, maybe we need toilets and some training in sanitation. So this time when we went back a couple of weeks ago, actually I just got back last week, we started installing toilets. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like that. You're just showing up, bearing witness, you know, seeing what's needed. And you have some ideas, you know, but you, when in my tours, we go with the expressed desire to lay down our "we know what you need" kind of mentality.
Yeah.
And to just be there with them and hear them speak. And, you know, it does so much for them, for us just to be there and to touch them, you know, because untouchability is the root of the issue. To just be able to be embraced by us does so much for them. To get out and to work alongside them does so much for them, you know. And so now we decided, well, they need education. Well, first, one of the schools that we're working with, the school doesn't even have, you know, it's a delete school. They don't even have a bathroom. So they have, you know, a couple of hundred kids and no bathroom. Mm-hmm. So when I go back in March, the first thing I'm going to do is put a bathroom in that school, you know, for the kids.
Wow. Is it with an organization that you connected with, or is it a community that invited you?
Well, I am working with an organization there called VIHARA, V-I-H-A-R-A, and a foundation of His Sacred Majesty. And these are two Dalit groups. One is a spiritual, you know, group, and the other, and they're both headed by the same person, but the other is a social activism platform. And I don't have any place here that I, you know, get money, but what I do is I give the money that I receive from Donna, my speaking engagements and my retreat. And I mean, my needs are very few, and I share what I'm doing and ask people to join with me, ask people to go with me, and I ask people to send money to invest in the lives of these people. And it's really taking off. The first trip, we just went to see, you know. Mm-hmm. The second trip, we came back and we started working with the well. And, you know, we have to meet with the upper caste leaders of the villages to ask them, can we do these things? I mean, there's no point in putting in a well if it's going to be poisoned the next day. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have to, there's some aspect of this that we have to begin to start working with the upper caste and not seeing them as a perpetrator or as an enemy or anything like that, you know. But just seeing it as people on two sides of an issue, of a belief system, you know, and not thinking of the Dalits as victims and not thinking of upper caste or the Hindu teachings and the as any kind of oppressive institution. It just is what it is, you know. And as we talk this way, we find that we are received, and they allow us to come into the communities and work with the Dalits and help. But what is happening is it's breaking down the animosity between the two groups, and it's so subtle, mm-hmm. you know. But now after 3 years, we see that happening, and they're beginning to work together because they're coming to know one another
yeah.
as human beings.
Huh. That's beautiful. And I guess the way that they talk about their struggle, do you see parallels to the African American struggle in the States? And you know, do they talk about their liberation in similar terms, or you know, as you said, that maybe they're trying to address the water and the sanitation needs before they start articulating kind of liberation mm-hmm. principles?
Well, you know, part of Ambedkar's you know, message was that the Buddha had a social platform, and that they have a book called The Buddha and His Dharma
mm-hmm.
that Ambedkar wrote, and it left out many of the things that I consider foundational or fundamental in developing an awakened mind, and it focuses purely on the social aspect. So part of my coming was to say there's something that needs to come before that, you know, in order to bring about social change. There's a certain cultivation of heart and mind that has to occur. So we kind of talk about these things as we work alongside each other, you know, and so that they can understand how it is. The reason I went, you know, because there's a lot of work I could be doing right here in America. But the reason I went is because the young man, Gotama, that invited me, he said, you know, in times past, we accepted this way of life. He said, but our children of today, they do not accept it. Says they will fight for their freedom, but they will die.
Wow.
And that's why I came. You know, I came for the children to show them a way to cut through, that there's a way to cut through ignorance without picking up weapons and fighting, without dying.
You know, Ambedkar, I was reading a biography of his recently, and you know, the conversion from Hinduism to Buddhism is perhaps the largest conversion, mass conversion of beings anywhere in the world. And
right.
And you do get the sense that it was a primarily political. You know, I think he engaged in Buddhism, but it was a primarily political reaction to kind of the oppression of Hinduism. And I think it's fascinating that you're kind of coming in from your deep tradition and practice to say, like, there is a foundation that comes before that, before you engage in some of the social or alongside, in parallel with engaging in the social aspects of Buddhist teachings, there's also a foundation that's needed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's true. And in all fairness, I think Ambedkar, you know, he was connecting them to the monastic community, but he died so suddenly and so quickly after that, and then that connection never really, you know, happened. It never took place. And so when I first started working with the activists, you know, this was really a sore point, a point of contention. And I had to share with them, well, you know, I have to tell you, Ambedkar wasn't a Buddhist practitioner. He investigated. He looked at the, quote, religion from the outside and said, this offers my people the greatest chance for having any kind of a life. I said, that's not the same thing as practice, you know. And you can't really say anything about in bed cost unless you're looking for a fight, you know. But I just wanted to tell the truth about it, you know,
yeah.
because I said, you know, but if you walk this walk, you know, with me, you will come to understand something, and you'll come to understand the deeper reality of the practice and of the walk. That part that is truly powerful, and it's not just rhetoric, you know, that can really sustain, and that can really break yokes, and that can really transform, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so over these 3 years, that's what's been happening. And so where there may be this idea of, you know, I don't have much get what I can get, you know, we used to call it here in America, we called it country slick. when guys would come up from the South to meet us northern girls. I know I got a southern twang, but I'm a northern girl. And, you know, and they try to put what we call that country slick on us, you know. and so when I go there, there's a lot of that sleight of hand, that double talk, fast talk, that male chauvinism, that even among the Dalits, you know, that little bit of dishonesty, you know, and I'll stop and I'll point it out right there.
Wow.
You know, and I'll say, well, now, in the beginning you told me this was going to cost X amount of dollars, but now you've come back 4 times with a different price. You know, so either you knew it was going to cost twice as much to begin with, or you're padding and adding on. So this is what I'm talking about not taking what is not given. It means, you know, and about not stealing, you know. So when you mislead me about something, that's stealing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't care if you recite the 5 precepts, you know, if you have your hand in my pocket.
Yeah, interesting with the precepts and just, yeah.
You know, and not pretending I didn't see it, and not, you know, but just right out front. See that right there? That's what I'm talking about. That's the wrong intention right there, you know. And so it's like training in that way, you know, that we don't say one thing and do another, but that our thoughts, our speech, and our action line up.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's this way, and they're beginning to really get it. You know, there's a sweet, loving people, without a doubt. I can't imagine how they can be so, you know, so sweet with the hardships that they go through. And that's why it's really fertile ground, you know, to work with them. It's a delight, it's a pleasure to work with them, because they don't really want to fight. You know,
yeah.
They just want to be able to have a life, be able to earn a living, you know. Their mothers just want their families taken care of. The fathers, most of them are drunks because they live in a society where, as men, they have not been able to provide for their families, and they certainly can't protect them, you know. And so there's so much work that needs to be done on so many, many levels. You know, but I see change in just 3 short years, just in this small area, you know, where we're working.
Wow.
Yeah. So I just wanted to plug in here that I think we have a couple of audience members with questions. So Gayathri, you've been unmuted. Please go ahead.
Hi, Venerable Panavati. Feeling so blessed to listen to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Into the Vipassana Center, I saw this 2 words inscribed on the stone. It would say, be happy. So, you know, I was just wondering, you know, is being happy, is it all about being happy, or is being happy a byproduct of mindfulness, or is it just a first step? If you could help me fully understand what that really means, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Mm.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Well, we have to start from some place, like what happiness means to me, you know. I mean, you can't really tell me what happiness would be to me. I mean, that's got to be something that comes up from inside of being. And I might not get the right answer when I start, but I start somewhere. And I ask myself, what is it that I'm unhappy about? Why don't we start there? You know, and as I start looking at the things that make me unhappy, I see that there has to be a very firm grasping around me for unhappiness to exist. And so I get a clue then that happiness might be found in not focusing so much on myself, but concentrating on others. And when I forget about myself, then all my troubles go away. So the Buddha says that there is a happiness that is found, and it's not of this world. That means that nothing in this world can give us lasting happiness, because everything is impermanent. Everything has a basic, fundamentally unsatisfactory to us, because even if it makes me happy now, if I have too much of it, I get sick of it. If I'm happy with it but it goes away, then it brings me suffering. You know. Mm-hmm. So he says, there's nothing in this world that's going to really make you happy. So you're going to have to look someplace else. And he says, if we look into the contentment of emptiness, not grasping around such a solid sense of a personal me, then I'm at the doorway to happiness.
Mm-hmm.
But my day is not always perfect. You know, there are many things that happen, and they don't feel good. They don't feel comfortable. But that's balanced out by the care and concern I have for others. And if we start just directing our life that way, we'll start to find out the things that we thought mattered so much don't really matter. These things out here, what we have, what we don't have, praise or blame, loss or gain, pleasure or pain, shame or fame, you know, they're just the shifting, vicissitudes of life, and that's what life is. Things come and things go. Things are good and not so good. But we can stand stable and fixed with a calm mind when we understand this is the way life is. So when I was talking earlier about putting everything like arm's length from you, that's kind of what I mean.
Mm.
You know, don't hold things so tightly to yourself. And as you do that, you'll find more happiness in just holding the world loosely and going with the flow. Mm. That's a starting point. So it's going to take a paradigm shift, you know. I see people with literally nothing, and they're happier than we are with too much. So our happiness then is really a state of mind, isn't it? I often tell a story. My father was a doorman, but he'd be dressed up in this suit that looked like a military suit with all these braids and brass and all of that. And I was so proud of him. And he took me to work with him one day. And I saw what he really did. He carried bags for people. Mm-hmm. And they,
He opened the door.
Yeah. He opened the door. And I got this thing in me about doors and opening doors. So you know how you go to the mall and you open the door and somebody walks right through like you opened it for them, you know? And that thing would upset me so bad. And if I was in a really bad mood, grab you when you walk through that door, you know? And I said, you think I opened this door for you? But now if I was in a middling mood and I opened the door and you walk through, I might just say, you're welcome. And I'd turn to my friend and say, he's so rude, you know? But if I was in a good mood, I'd open the door and you walk through. You know, it just, you know, it didn't mean anything to me. It gave me pleasure to hold the door for you. you know. Mm-hmm. So what was the difference? It was just the opening of the door and somebody mm-hmm. walking through when I opened it. No, but the difference was my own mental state, you see. Mm-hmm. So if you look at it, then happiness or sadness or anger, all of that, it's in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So the work has to be done in the mind, training the mind to not so easily take offense, where we do a lot of suffering for some of us, particularly activists.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think we have to end on that note. Sorry we're out of time. I myself have a bunch of other questions, but I just wanted to thank you, Venerable Panavati. I think most of us that are trying to be activists in the world, there's sometimes not the level of wisdom that you're bringing to the table, and I think that you know, we, there's a saying of we make the road by walking it, and I think you're very much walking it and lighting the path for a lot of us to also kind of follow your example. So I just wanted to say this conversation has been a great joy for me, and I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much. And if anyone wants to just write me, they can feel free. My email is panyawati2@yahoo.com.
Yeah. Thank you, Venerable Panavati. We'll share out details of your contact information with the audience and if folks want to follow up with further questions as well. So before we wrap up, we'll just do kind of a collective moment of silence to end our conversation, and then I'm going to unmute all the callers so we can do a big shout-out, thank you, and goodbye to for in gratitude to you joining our call today. So let's just go into a moment of silence, and then we'll end with a collective thank you.